Welcome to So-and-So, brought to you by Bernina, Made to Create. I'm Meg Goodman, and you're about to enjoy a casual conversation with a special member of the Soist community. A conversation about how they got started, what inspires them, what excites them, and their connection to this community. Our guest today is Christina Wong, a performance artist, comedian, writer, and elected representative who's been presented internationally across North America, the UK, Hong Kong, and Africa. She's been a guest on late-night shows on NBC, Comedy Central, and FX, and an actor on film and TV. A prolific and internationally recognized performer, Christina's current project is the Anti-Sewing Squad, and that's A-U-N-T-I-E. It's a national network of volunteers sewing masks for vulnerable communities, which Christina started as a casual effort to connect her with other friends sewing homemade masks for essential workers. Originally intended as a three-week stopgap, the Anti-Sewing Squad is still sewing and has since exploded into a network of hundreds of active antis across the United States who have shipped tens of thousands of masks to vulnerable communities across the North American continent. The Anti-Sewing Squad has been featured on CNN, NBC, Washington Post, Good Morning America, and many more. And coming soon, We Go Down Sewing, which is a cross between an anthology, memoir, and a visual record of the work of the Anti-Sewing Squad, will be published in the fall of 2021. Hi, Christina, and welcome to So-and-So.
Hi, Meg. I feel like I have such street cred now in the sewing community. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. You're doing a lot of stuff.
Too much all the time.
And, you know, with your performances, you've got one coming up soon and all throughout the year, and those take up a lot of your time. You've also found room for the Anti-Sewing Squad. So let's go back to the beginning with your sewing and tell us how you learned to sew.
Well, sewing has always been a part of my life. I grew up in San Francisco, where I went to public school, and I could have chosen to do orchestra or home ec. And I always had regrets around not choosing orchestra until this moment right now. But I learned to sew in a home ec class. But my mother also sewed, and it's something that the women in my family always did, whether it was to repair clothing or not. My grandparents, who were immigrants from Toisan, China, had a laundry and alterations business also. So I come from a family where a lot of extended family members worked in garments, whether it's making garments or cleaning garments was part of our passage into mm-hmm. America. Mm-hmm. So some of that I picked up from them, but I never became like a very expert tailor. I like to describe the way I use a sewing machine as like, it's a fancy stapler. just attaches stuff together. So this last year has just been like really kind of an over the top engagement with sewing.
Sure. What's the first thing you ever made? Do you remember?
Yes. So our home ec sewing class, we had to buy like I don't even know if they make these any, the yardage, and it's like it's a kit, and you can you actually cut around the shape, and then you sew a pillow basically, and it was a teddy bear shaped pillow from the store, but I don't even know. I guess you can still buy those things, but it would be trickier to find the fabric store. I guess at this point you go to like a corporate store like Joann's or something, but then. Back then, we had like the smaller owned fabric stores that had those things. And we spent like a few weeks working on this pillow. Like one day it was just cutting, then it was just making the darts. Then then we run it through the sewing machine and turn it inside out and sew it shut. But I'd always like hand sewed to repair things like buttons, watch my mom sew quilts and helped her. But I was never like super hardcore in terms of taking on projects like that. And only recently in the last few years started sewing the set pieces for my show. And that's with felt, which you don't have to seam.
So let's talk about those props. Before we do though, do you still have that pillow?
don't know. I think if it is, it's at my parents' house. And I was talking with my friends about how parents' homes is like where we just stash things that we're like hoarding. We've turned their homes into like extended storage.
I don't think that's unique, though. I think a lot of parents' homes are storage places.
Yeah. if I do, I know we had it for a long time because I totally remember what it was. Christmas themed.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, I totally remember it. I remember how mean my home ec teacher is, Mrs. King, and and how she would just scream at students, like stuff that you couldn't even get away with now. And like, I remember one student accidentally, like someone else's project from another class was there, and he accidentally cut into his project and was, this is like so inappropriate to tell you, she was like, oh, you just cut so-and-so's project. You know, he's a very big guy. Like basically threatening that this student is going to come for you because you cut into his project, which I like reflect on now. I'm like, this is so ridiculous and so wrong. But I remember she was just like terrifying.
Times have changed,
but that's how I learned to sew. Like she was my first sweatshop overlord, I guess.
Well, you know, so Sweatshop Overlord is the name of one of your shows. Mm-hmm.
Your current show.
That's right. And you do sew props for your show. So obviously you picked up some pretty good skills. Let's talk about your inspiration for these props. And do you have a favorite that you've created?
Yeah. So I've created sets for two shows, and I'm working on a new show now called Christina Wong Sweatshop Overlord. But my show in 2015 was called The Wong Street Journal, and it was about my travels to Uganda and working with a microloan organization that gave microloans just to women. And when I came back from that trip, I was like, oh no, this is going to sound like a terrible colonial story of an American that went to Africa. But to me, it was much more nuanced because I'm an Asian American woman and was really, I think, navigating this complicated terrain of what it's like to be a person of color who's also American going to another country of color and trying to be of support and realizing how troubled that is. And I had realized if I sew my own set pieces, it sort of softens the way the audience experiences this kind of naive story that I tell them. And I describe the subculture of, kind of evolved this term cancel culture, right? Evolved and devolved, right?
Right.
but this idea of you post something on the internet or you post reflect, like for me, I posted a reflection of my trip and everyone's like, this is problematic. And how it's like very hard to have any kind of self-effacing experiences that you report aloud on the internet without making it fair game for everyone to go into. So I literally decided the way I would address this in the show is to have a hashtag war with the audience where I describe the kind of culture of fighting with people online and like using a hashtag attached to it so that everyone, like, this is the local bar we're all fighting at. They all jump in on that hashtag.
Sure.
Pick away, and then they and as you tweet, more and more people follow you and retweet you, and you it's like this weird game, an ideological warfare. But so I sewed these felt hashtags, hundreds of them, and I'm throwing them in the audience, and the audience is throwing them back, and I'm describing what it's like to have a fight online, and look how productive this is.
Uh-huh.
And the whole joke being is it really productive or have we just like torn apart and created more tension that will trickle into in real life interactions with people? And so that is a favorite prop I've made that the audience loves because they love, like, who doesn't love throwing things like a Gallagher show at the audience and back? And I think it's a very tactile way to describe what is otherwise kind of a, you know, this culture that's very digital, to bring it back into this tactile fabric space. So that is, I think, one of my props. But for that show and my last show, I made basically a replica of the New York Stock Exchange. And then this recent show, Christina Wong for Public Office, where I ran for office, I've made a whole patriotic set with bunting and American flag podium and a presidential seal. I sewed that also with felt. So very proud of my set work.
And do you design and do this all yourself?
Yes. Wow. So I never really took a set design course. I was very intimidated by the idea of like, I can design a set. I thought you had to like hire fancy people to do that. And I had always been sewing. I'd been sewing things that don't require a lot of measuring. So I sew a lot of dolls. And I was doing it mostly to sort of relieve stress from from my line of work and make little like presents like that if a baby was born, make them an owl with wings and stuff and all this kind of stuff that I could just estimate and guesstimate. And I just stumbled upon one day, like, how are we going to explain the culture of internet wars? Or how am I going to go through this, talk about this complicated story about me going to Africa without an audience just sort of resenting me? And was like, oh, if I make all my sets and props, it'll endear me a little bit to them so they can listen a little longer as I tell all these not so flattering stories about myself, but then also talk about what I learned in the process and get into the complexities of it.
And it works.
And it worked. And it was intimidating, but it was really just hanging about making large wall hangings. And I think sometimes people, as I've learned, are very intimidated by sewing. But if you can try to kind of just look at it like it's a fancy stapler,
right?
Like ease into like that. You don't have to make a wedding dress on your first go,
mm-hmm.
you know. But maybe just like a little doll, make a little doll for somebody, and go, oh, I made that. That wasn't that bad. That was easy, and free yourself to think, you know, the eyes don't have to exactly be 2 inches apart. Like you can have an eyeball here. You can have mismatched buttons, and I think that can be quite freeing. And I just lent that thinking to, all right, I've never made a set before, but I was the best person to do it because I know I tour my shows and I usually need to get these sets into check-in luggage. And then when I get to a place, need to be able to take up a lot of space really quickly. And sets made of metal or wood, you know, I'd have to freight and spend thousands of dollars to send. Whereas fabric, I just kind of unfurl it and clamp it or pin it to a back wall, depending what kind of space I've been given to perform in. And I can take up a lot of space very quickly for very little money. And also just feel very proud at this like childlike aesthetic of a set that I made behind me.
And it sounds like there is personality in the imperfection too. You were talking about, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. And there's a little bit of you in whatever imperfections are there.
Yeah. And I think it's sort of, I think that's the aesthetic that now my work sort of leans on. It's sort of the childlike, the sewing and the you see the little bubbling mm-hmm. on the fabric and you can tell that the stars were sort of sketched out by hand and cut out by hand. And I think there's so much more of appreciation for the work.
Sure. When
you can see things like that.
So I want to move to the anti-sewing squad because this is such a passion of yours. And I want you to tell us who they are, where they located, how people joined, lots of questions. And how did you bring this all together? There's a great story here.
Oh, there's so much. So my tour of Christina Wong for Public Office, which is about how I ran for local office here in Koreatown, Los Angeles, and won. And the show plays out like a big raucous rally that happens in person. So the whole idea was I was supposed to have this whole live in person, crazy raucous rally leading up to the election in November last year. And it was all postponed. Everyone's show was postponed. It was terrifying. And suddenly I was deemed non-essential, which a lot of artists were. And I'm just kind of bummed out at home. I'm out thousands of dollars in income, no idea how I'm going to make a living. And saw this article, a friend passed me, that the hospitals were looking for cloth face masks because we were not prepared for this epidemic at all. And we were not prepared for a home sewing movement because even big corporate stores like Joann's or Michael's, they were completely out of quarter inch flat braided elastic, which was like, mm-hmm. which was like the mana from yeah. heaven if you could find it at the top of the pandemic. So I being the hoarder I am, I had like a half a yard of fabric, which seemed like so much, of cotton fabric. I had plenty of felt, which you can't make masks with. And I made a mask on my Hello Kitty sewing machine. And I was like, I did it. I made a mask. I can save a nurse. And very naively offered to the world, hey, if you're immunocompromised or a frontline worker and you do not have access to masks. I will make you one. Just reimburse me for shipping. Mm-hmm. And I got some of the most terrifying emails I'd ever seen from nurses who are like, my hospital is out. They're telling us to wear bandanas around our face. I'm scared to go to work tomorrow. My friend Serenya, the first Asian American firefighter in New York, was like, we are down to our last N95s in our unit. Can you send backup masks? And I'm like, yes, I can do it. And just, I didn't even have the materials, but I was going to figure out how to do it. And, I was able at most, it was an exhausting day. I made 35 in a day. But it was like for every, 30 that I would send out, like a request for 90 more would come in. And it's like, how do you say no to people who are saving lives? Right. And then it was also just requests from everyone who was like, I have asthma. I'm so scared. Can you make me a mask? I'm not leaving my house now, but I just said yes to everybody. And I think this is a problem I have, is that I'm a little bit of a martyr. And this is an ongoing theme in my life, is mm-hmm. I'm always like, yes, I can do it. I can do it. And I think, it felt so patriotic. It felt so clear in the moment. Like, this is what we who are non-essential are going to do. We're going to do this for a few weeks until all these masks arrive from the factories in China, because, shipping had been slowed down mm-hmm. because they were impacted by the virus, obviously. Or the government's going to step in and get masks to everyone. FEMA will step in. So this will just be what we do for the next few weeks so we can get through this, flatten the curve, and get back to life in a couple months.
Mm-hmm. Three weeks.
So within a matter of days, I was like, I'm not going to be able to do this. So I created a Facebook group called Auntie Sewing Squad. The reason why I called it that was I didn't want to commit. There were mask making groups that had been forming, and they were huge. There were like thousands of people in the group. And I'm like, I don't know how to wave these folks down to help me. Because they're probably all dealing with their hospitals. I don't want to commit to helping them with theirs right now, because I'm just trying to like flatten this list. And I don't want to commit to something big by calling it masks for COVID or masks for America. And yet the great irony is we are like still standing as a group, and these other groups have closed. So, and I called it Auntie Sewing Squad because of my neighbor who was helping me cut was like, yeah, aunties right now are basically being deployed to fix this. And I love this image of aunties, because it makes me think of a non-threatening immigrant lady who's just kind of caring and sweet, who's basically doing the work of a soldier. So, I had no idea that the acronym was ASS. I literally was like half reclined on my bed, panicked, creating this group. And I just added a few friends who I saw were sewing. And they all happen to be Asian women, which I don't think is a coincidence. It's not that they were my friends and that's why they were Asian, but because they also had family members who were seamstresses and garment workers, and that's how they had learned the skill. And here we are. We're suddenly the Auntie Sewing Squad. And when you start a Facebook group centered around sewing, it doesn't run itself. Like, masks do not automatically appear.
Right.
It was complete panic in the group. It's not like we were experts at doing this. And there was still a lot of misinformation going around, like, masks are optional. Like, even the CDC was like, it's really to prevent a cold, and it's if you're already sick. And, and of course, obviously, that shifted rapidly. Mm-hmm. So we're like reading all these efficacy studies, like what we could find. We're reading all these patterns. We're like, do we put it in a filter pocket? What kind of filter do we get? What was these filters safe? Like, it was just mass panic. And because I had been, everyone, who couldn't sew was just feeling helpless. They were throwing donations at me so that I could make masks for folks. But the crazy thing was there were no materials to buy. So it was more like an issue of like, we need labor. So I ended up running the group and mailing elastic and fabric, and collecting fabric from people, whether it was people who worked in interior design or people who just dropped off their quilt, the quilt stash. Or someone dropped off old clothing, and I was like, I really can't use your old socks right now. No one wants, I know we're desperate right now, but we can't put old socks
not that
on doctor faces, right? But like, that's, but it was like, people were cutting up t-shirts at the top of this. And I had to like direct this and mail this to people in different, we weren't organized regionally. A lot of these groups were organized regionally, and I was sending stuff all over the country. And every week we'd have like requests from 100 new people to join. And it was just like such mass chaos because people were, you know, people themselves weren't covered, let alone the most essential of workers. And so it was just, there was a lot of confusion too in the group because some people came to us as if they could just order masks. And it was becoming clear that burnout was going to become very real, really quickly. And people, who were sewing and it's hard to stop sewing when you know, oh, I can save lives, and you're watching the news and it's horrifying. So I was like, we need to come up with a system to care for the aunties, but I don't want to use the donations that we've been getting for masks to like pay for Postmates delivery or whatever. So people were also offering me pizza because they saw how stressed out I was.
Pizza fixes everything.
Yeah,
it does.
Yeah. And I'm not food insecure, but it was like really hard to stop. And I'd lost all this weight. I have since gained it, Meg. But
pizza does that too.
from just running around, like I'd wake up in the morning to a bunch of texts. Like, I know someone who works for this fashion company. Call them right now. I know someone who does this, and you know, and just tending to all these emails and stuff. And people were like, let me send over some food. And I don't need to eat 12 pizzas in a day. So I asked my friend Gail to, can you help reroute some of these offers for pizza to other aunties who are sewing right now, so they know that they are appreciated and being cared for. Like, it's not a way, it's not us paying them. It's just us saying, keep going, but take a break and know that we care about you.
Sure.
And we're not, while you're being exploited, you're not totally being exploited because we're sending you a pizza, you know? And that became our system of auntie care. So we've become a very unique group in that it quickly became clear that these hospitals have marketing teams to communicate their needs to sewing groups. But there are probably a lot of people out there who don't have marketing teams, who don't even have internet access, who are in much more rural, remote areas who need help. So we had to shift our someone had sent like just an infographic saying, please send masks to farm workers and with an email address. And I was thinking, yeah, this sounds like a community that we need to figure out how to reach, but it also feels really scary to just send your stuff to a PO box that you see in an infographic, right? Like,
right,
how many
right.
masks do you want? Who's distributing them? How long has this infographic been going around? Are you already covered? So we created a system within our group called Super Aunties who went out and just like made these phone calls and figured out exactly how many do you need? How many sizes, you know, do you need kid sizes, adult sizes? Like what do you need exactly? And how is it going to get distributed? Cause you don't want to spend like your entire day making masks that sit on the floor of an office
mm-hmm.
or get resold on, you know, like you want them to go right onto faces. And very quickly we ended up shifting from, it went from medical workers, of course we won't charge you. Of course to like, you need masks? What's wrong with you? Right? Because a few months in, it's like, once the supply chain began to restore itself, it made no sense that these billion-dollar hospitals need our free labor
mm-hmm.
As much as farm workers and indigenous reservations and those communities that were really poor. We were also sending to migrants seeking asylum at the border
mm-hmm.
and incarcerated communities
mm-hmm.
who were super impacted. And a lot of that took a lot of vetting and researching. And, you know, when we looked at all these communities, we were like, wow, what they all seem to have in common is they all are communities of color. They've all been ignored largely by the federal government. They've all been impacted by this country's history of systemic racism. And that's what all these communities that we're serving at the moment seem to have in common.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not lost on us, especially as after George Floyd's murder, and we were really just sort of watching the world go by from behind our sewing machines and trying to understand, like, how can we support these people when we're too afraid to go out into the street?
You know, you have noticed and recognized that your work holds a ton of political power, because as you mentioned, you find yourself sewing for communities who you fight for in your activism, and you say you realize this through labor and fabric. So dig in a little bit deeper about this political power, finding your voice as a group, and the specific needs of the people that you're fighting for. Because it really evolved.
Yeah, no, I totally went into this going, oh, this is like this is the first time I'm not doing something that's crazy leftist, like like radical Christina Wong. This is just me helping my fellow Americans, because my health is your health. All health matters. You know, I put a mask on you, it protects you and everyone around you. Mm-hmm. And then as week after week went by, going, why are we still sewing? Why aren't the masks here? Why hasn't FEMA stepped in? It felt like what we were doing was helping all the communities that don't receive help. And that began to feel very political. It also was very clear that as many aunties as there were, and as fast as we seemed to be working, we were not expendable. And when we'd have interactions with people who would treat us like we were expendable, or that we were some free version of Amazon Prime, where like, if I just send these women an address and name off some crazy high number of masks, masks will just show up. And we didn't like our labor be feeling disrespected or devalued that way. Mm-hmm. Cause already, you know, it's not that we would have turned out masks faster had we been paid. A lot of us have jobs or have, you know, things we need to do with our time. But it's those moments when the request for masks didn't seem to respect our time, or the fact that we also have families, that we're also terrified of this virus, that we also have jobs and obligations and losses that we're navigating, that we were like, we need to educate people how to respect this labor, because it's almost like this labor of sewing has been rendered so invisible in our culture, that we're so used to just like we press a few buttons and an item shows up, that we don't have to think about the fact that someone was probably underpaid in a factory, you know, in their 12th hour of work that day, sewing it. Mm-hmm. And when that sort of is being reflected back to us, that doesn't feel good. That doesn't feel respectful. So we had to be, this is where we had to create a mission statement and a list of core values and really get clear about where our labor was going. And that began to feel like a political act. And it became very clear that the government had failed us, that some of these requests that we were navigating were clearly requests that FEMA or local government should be handling. And yet I'm handling it. So for example, I got this request from someone who's in Los Angeles, but is a member of a tribal nation in Alaska, a very rural village tribal nation. And there was COVID infections there, but all their masks that were headed there were stuck in a holding facility. They couldn't get over to this small village. So she had figured out that if the aunties could sew masks and send it to this nonprofit, that this one jet she found was willing to volunteer and fly those masks over. And I'm like, this is stuff that FEMA should be trying to figure out, not a performance artist out of work with no shoes on inside her house at her Hello Kitty sewing machine with someone else who's also volunteering and trying to figure out how to help her elders, right? Mm-hmm. And this is disgraceful, right? that this kind of level of just trying to figure out how to get fabric with elastic to someone else.
And it's so much more than that.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's tons of like requests like this. So it became very political. When the protests were happening all summer, we sent masks in solidarity to the hometowns of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, as ways, because we felt so frustrated, like at these outright like murders of unarmed Black people, and we were just like, how do we show these communities that we care and we care about their safety? So we sent masks in honor of these slain folks to the NAACPs mm-hmm. in their hometowns, right? As gestures, because it felt like the only way we could literally say, this is us sending our form of protection and support to you. And we sewed these masks with intention. But we also had masks that went out to medics and stuff who were at the protests to offer to other protesters who had no masks on, didn't have masks. And that felt like our way of being there in support of them without, a lot of us weren't ready to be out in crowds for obvious reasons. But as it turns out, a lot of those crowds are already very well masked. And mm-hmm. as evidenced by like the masks work, because there were anti-mask protests and rallies for certain political candidates where people wore no masks and infection spread really quickly. And then they looked at the infection rates among folks who were participating in these outdoor rallies and stuff. And the ones who were masked didn't experience the same kind of surge.
Were you able to get those masks to Alaska on that jet?
Yes. Yeah. And that was insane because we couldn't sew fast enough. We were just like, at that point, we were also, this is also what felt political, is we were looking at, we have one auntie, I call her Antony Fauci. Constance is her, and she's an actor, right? and she's an actor, and she's now started a nonprofit, the Lakota Wellbeing Project, with folks at Standing Rock. And she looks at charts, and she looks at water tables, and she tries to understand, you know, because there's lots of reservations we could send masks to, but we, like, you know, we don't have infinite capacity to sew, and we're not sitting on piles of masks. Like, as soon as they're done, we send them out, like, as soon as we can get them out of here. Mm-hmm. And she, and their governor had lifted a mask mandate and checkpoints for testing, and unfortunately Standing Rock as a result suffered huge infection rates. And you also have families or multi-generations are living in the same home. So if one person's infected, they all get sick very quickly. So we felt like we are going to send, you know, I think the first pledge was like 5,000 masks to Standing Rock, almost in defiance of this governor, right? We have to get the masks because the culture of the state is not, and policy almost like makes it seem like it's okay to walk around without a mask. And if she's lifting their mask mandate, then clearly she's not providing masks for people who live here, and certainly not in these rural areas on these reservations. So that felt really political. It felt like our own version of protest. And in many ways, it felt like this whole last 15 months we've been fighting a guerrilla war from inside the United States, from behind our sewing machines, by just like looking at these communities that are impacted. And like literally, we had 6 vans worth of hygiene and masks making supplies and masks drive to the Navajo Nation. And this is not to the tribal government, but to other mutual aid efforts, mm-hmm. right? Like people who are sort of working outside systems that didn't work to create their own systems to try to get stuff to the communities who weren't accessing it.
You know, it truly has evolved from day one. What's really, and no telling where it will go. What's super impressive is on your website, which is antisewingsquad.com, you have your core values, which are transparency, passion, humor, and kindness. And then to top that off, you have 8 stated principles about who you are, what you do, why you do things. And that involves a little bit of thought and some time and conversation in the midst of everything else.
Well, a lot of it came just from getting really annoying requests.
Sure.
Someone asked, like, oh, my dental office would really love masks with our logo that we would give as a promotional thing. Oh. Would you we don't make promotional materials for, you know, we don't do kind of custom work for your wedding, for your pandemic wedding, or for your whatever. Like, we're trying to stop genocides right now in communities. And then people who are like, oh, I know you're trying to raise money for the Navajo Nation. I'd love to purchase some masks with my husband's music studio name on it. And I'm like, no, like people are giving us money with the expectation they get nothing in return, but that we do this work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I know that so many other fundraising models are like, oh, we're having a raffle and then we use the raffle money to do the work. It's like, for me, it was like very clear that if we're at the point where we need to sell things to take the money that we yield to do the work, that maybe this work is not that urgent or important. So it was a lot to deal with that. I was also getting really annoyed with people using the word order. And a lot of it's like, it's very innocent. Like,
sure.
People asking, hey, can I order a few masks? But it just made me feel like I'm not a store. I'm not a factory. I make no money from this. This is me trying to keep you healthy. So please use the word request.
And
know that if you have money to buy the stuff, that maybe you should figure out where to get it. Like, I don't need you to do this because you think you're supporting me by giving me money for a mask. Like, this is really for those who have no access to this whatsoever. And because really we were, and there were a lot of people urging us to become a nonprofit. And I see there's a lot of value, I guess, in starting a nonprofit, but it also then becomes a job. And that has overhead and a board, and the way mutual aid works, it's like, how do we just get the work done without all that bureaucracy?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to be doing this forever. And that's what an organization would be doing, is sort of doing this forever. I want this to be sort of a loose network that has a bit of flexibility to support each other and shift and do things. And so we had to become kind of clear, because we kept getting the same requests. And I will say that I tried to throw money at this problem at the beginning of this. I tried to figure out, are there out of work garment workers that I can hire and just make this go away? And I got in touch with the Garment Worker Center, and the Garment Worker Center is not an employment agency, but they do advocate on the rights of folks who are garment workers. And it was taking them so long to get set up and to communicate to their workers. It was like, it was faster for me to get these aunties set up to work for free than to try to figure out how to pay people with the money I was being donated. So that to me was a clear example that capitalism was not going to get us out of this situation.
Sure.
That it was actually, what was hardest was to find the labor and the organizational prowess, and the money has been the easiest part of it. And, it was like, you can keep sending me money, but there's no elastic I can purchase. We were so scrappy at the top of this. So, but people were approaching us, with this framework that if I offer you more money, that will somehow get me my mask faster or get me what I want right now. And this was complete homesteading,
yeah.
Where your money is worthless right now. What I need is you to actually sit down and cut some pieces a fabric for me. That would actually be more valuable.
It sounds like this goes a lot back to your number one principle, which is we seek to be obsolete, not profitable.
Yep. We don't. Some of the aunties are like, what if we make menstrual pads? And what if we, and I'm like, you can do that. but I don't know if you understand, aunties, like my living room at many points in this pandemic looked like a warehouse, looked like a medical supply warehouse. So I just had rolls of fabric coming in and out of the house. And still right now I have like all these sewing supplies that, and I do feel like we are in our last chapter. And at this point, it's really about us getting masks to these communities that just aren't able to access any kind of overstock or free masks. But it's a lot to get hundreds of people working remotely to keep them going.
It is.
This has been an insane project in terms of the amount of labor and organizing we've done, but a lot of it has been built out of crisis.
How many aunties are there now?
I would say our group boasts over 800 who are not necessarily active. They've been all active in different ways. So that includes care aunties. At one point we had the phenomenon of driving aunties, who we needed to just get fabric driven from place to place, and someone to do the post office runs because we were just working so furiously. And then we just have Rebecca Solnit. I call her our writer historian shakedown auntie, because she doesn't necessarily so she does sew. She's very slow, but she's much better as an auntie who's connected and writes about us in different articles that she writes, but also has been able to connect us to a lot of her fan base and connect us to aunties who sew and also make donations. So it's hard to count. We've had to do purges of like, who is this auntie mm-hmm. who joined and we've never heard a peep from. But at this point, I would say we've had about 800 people come through and done some work.
Now, when you talk about the sewing squad, you said that it's important to point out that while the auntie sewing squad embraces all genders, mm-hmm. a lot of the aunties are Asian American women.
Yes.
As many were taught this skill through their mothers and grandmothers who did garment work as a survival skill in America. And you then connect that to you and you say, well, you've lost connection to your grandparents because of assimilation and language loss.
Yeah.
You feel that sewing is a skill that connects you to the past.
Yep.
Tell us about your grandparents and this connection.
Yeah, I never, my grandfather learned to speak pretty rudimentary English. And so I kind of got away with never learning to speak Toisan to them, their dialect to them. And mm-hmm. I live with so much guilt in my childhood that my grandma would be talking to me. I knew when she would like emotionally what was happening because sure. Cantonese and Toisan is a very emotionally like tonal language. But I never fully could have full conversations with her. And you know, as I went to college and like was an English major and like studied so much about theory, I just felt so disconnected to any kind of skill that I felt like I just became this weird theory person. But sewing and knitting were like kind of the skills that I could do that women have done for generations. And I remember working at, I do have one grandmother who's still alive, and I was knitting a scarf and I passed through the needles and I have a very hard time communicating with her too. And she started to add stitches to it. And it was like the most profound thing sure. that we had like worked together on this scarf. And it was a language we both knew. She still knew how to do stitches.
Yeah.
On it. So that's a thing. I think when I was in Uganda watching women sew on like the non-electricity powered sewing machines, like, you know how people stop in the street and check out cars? Like I would like stop on the street and check out their sewing machine and felt like that's so cool that like while I don't really totally understand this particular sewing machine, that's so cool that's something that you and I can do, because otherwise I just feel like this weird colonial presence here.
But you had a common language in the sewing.
Yeah. And it's if you've ever made a gift for someone, even if it's kind of sloppy, it's a lot of, you're like looking at their time in each stitch, especially knitting. You know, you're really like looking at like each inch of that has been touched with a finger, mm-hmm. right? And even sewing too. So that's sort of what was this connection. And I think the joke that I was becoming a sweatshop overlord came very early on, in that I was like, oh my God, all the first volunteers are Chinese. This is like this weird ancestral destiny where like my grandparents who worked these like blue collar jobs, like no one's dream is to like have a laundry, but their dream right. is to be an American, you know, and to have American children who can take advantage of the American dream. So they, you know, they went through this pain of working these long, crazy hours in these jobs that they were maybe quote unquote overqualified for Chinese Americans, garment labor was almost like one of the few options of labor because, they were considered the yellow peril when they came to America mm-hmm. and, the white settlers who were already there didn't like the idea that Asians were coming for our jobs. We see the sort of theme now with immigration that mm-hmm. so-and-so is coming for our jobs. And so they took the jobs that no one wanted to take, which is cooking, caretaking kind of labor, and also sewing and garment work, which is very underpaid. So when I saw that all my first volunteers were Asian women, I was like, oh my God, mm-hmm. we're doing it again. Like America failed to prepare. Yeah. And now we're all college educated, but we're doing this labor that our grandparents did so that the nurses don't die, you know? And it was sort of a survival tactic for me as a comedian to lean into that humor of your sweatshop overlord, you better keep sewing or I'm going to chop your fingers off. Right. The sort of persona of this overbearing, unreasonable boss that's like yelling at. So that's become the sort of point of humor in the group, is that I'm the overlord. And now not all the aunties are Asian American, but they still call me the overlord. And a lot of the humor in the group is like, better keep sewing she's going to chop off her fingers. And there was a point too, when it was really bad in that spike. And I remember thinking, you know, that this is the end of the world. And if we're going to go down, we go down sewing. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like General Patton or like, you know, this military commander, like going, we're just going to keep sewing. Because what else are you going to do? Just sit and panic?
Sure.
So.
Sure. Christina, what's your dream for the future of the aunties and what's next for you?
Well, as hard as this year has been of this project, I will say that this group has taught all of us involved in this just what it's like to be generous with each other. I mean, I've met so many people. When you meet people in the context of like, you're also in this group sewing masks because you care about other people, it sort of connects you to people in this very specific way. And because our group is the Auntie Sewing Squad, the aunties have come into the group connecting to each other with this sort of family vibe, right? We refer to each other as aunties and super aunties. And we've even gotten thank you letters from groups where this one guy signs off Nephew Jorge and is thinking, and it's like so sweet, right?
It's perfect.
So we've become this kind of like weird pandemic family. And yet most of us have never met each other in person. And I feel like I have all these like sisters and brothers and non-binary siblings all over the country. If I'm traveling in their town, we can immediately just have a meal and, you know, speak as if we're all old friends. And I look forward to, what I call our retirement parties, where the book comes out, our book comes out in the fall, and where we have book launches in different communities where aunties live, and we meet each other for the first time and have potlucks and open sewing. And we talk about like what it was like to do this labor at this time in the world and what it was like to give so generously and connect to people out of such care and generosity and how we take that forward. Because I had never felt so generous in my life the first few days of that years, but for a few days of the pandemic, I was just like, wow, I feel so giving. And then I was like getting like, okay, I'm getting, okay, we're now 5 months of this and I'm getting kind of drained. But, you know, to care for each other in this way was incredible. And I think we can learn a lot about how to be in the world.
Sure.
From this point of generosity. And so I just sort of hope we can kind of share that story with those who've benefited from our labor and others who didn't know what to do in this time and are thinking of ways to give and be. And it seems counterintuitive when everything seems to be taken from you to give more, right? Like that seems so weird and scary, but that is actually what helped a lot of us survive and find our power.
And the story is still being written almost every day. And you have no idea what the next chapter is going to be either.
Every day. Yeah. So, you know, and I'm also touring my show, Christina Wong Sweatshop Overlord. I think it's okay to announce, but in the fall, I will be doing a real life show in New York City at New York Theater Workshop. So this show that I've been developing on Zoom, I'm going to rewrite for a live audience in November and tell the story of this crazy guerrilla warfare sewing group that I started out of the pandemic and what we learned. And I think particularly what's poignant, this one thing we didn't talk about is because so many of us are Asian American, it was very clear that there was a lot of backlash and there still is a lot of backlash against Asian Americans right now. Mm-hmm. And we as a group really felt it after the Atlanta massacre, when the spa workers six spa workers of Asian descent were massacred, and then two others. And the group has become a, not just like about like get work done, but we talk a lot about why our labor continues to need to exist. Mm-hmm. But also we were sort of expressing, a lot of aunties were expressing how fearful we felt about going out into the street. That while this pandemic, this health pandemic is ending, we are now in this ongoing racial pandemic for many communities of color. But I think especially for a lot of Asian Americans, this is the first time we felt this frightened to be out mm-hmm. in public, in the street. I think I've heard expressed from some Asian Americans that they're afraid of reopening because now we have to go back out in public where people can just come at us, right? We can't just hang out inside. And so as a form of auntie care, we a few things happened. One, we released a statement about the violence, which is something that usually political groups do. And here we are, a sewing group, releasing a statement on the anti-Asian violence, connecting our labor of care making to the care work that a lot of Asian Americans have performed when they get to this country, especially these spa workers, and sort of referencing the connections to the way this labor is gendered. Mm-hmm. And racialized often, and it's often associated as like both massage work and sewing work is often just associated with Asian women do this work. But we also partnered with a group called Holla Back to do bystander intervention training. That's different than self-defense training, but it's like, it's for anybody. Like, what do you do when you are at the bus stop and you witness someone being harassed? Like, how do you help defuse and intervene?
Tell us again the name of that group.
Holla Back.
Okay, that's important.
Holla Back. Mm-hmm. Yes. So we've partnered with them to get the word out about that training. But we also did a self-defense training within our group with a dojo in New York mm-hmm. So that the aunties feel safer. Serenya, who I brought her up, the first Asian firefighter in New York. So the great irony is a year ago, I made her fire unit masks. And now she is distributing the self-defense weapons for your keychain and a mini hand alarm. She got white allies to help pay for these kits to distribute to Asian elders, and youth and women and Asian Americans who would feel safer if they have them. So a lot of the aunties who've been sewing masks now are receiving this form of, who've been sewing protection are now receiving this form of self-defense protection from someone who I sent protection to a year mm-hmm. ago. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's, so that's definitely like this dynamic of our group and something that I don't know how we stop this racial pandemic with fabric at the moment, but, and sewing, but it's a way our group has been organized. And even the white aunties in our group have formed a white ally group to figure out anti-racist strategies among themselves and how they can support us. So I do appreciate that more so than like if they were just like, oh, sorry that's happening, right? Like right. It feels like they're doing something active.
You know, I'm positive that our listeners would like to reach out to you for more information or to how to get involved or just watching all of this evolve. Christina, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
Yeah, they can go to auntiesewingsquad.com. I'm terrible lately. Like when we get a big press bump, we get tons of emails and I don't get a chance to write everyone back. But you can try.
You have a few things happening.
Yeah, there's a lot happening. Sure. At this point, it's hard for us to take in new aunties. But if you happen to be sitting on an overflow of masks, we still have some addresses that can use them. And if you're looking for ways to support the aunties, we're always open to using that support.
And the beautiful thing of this is who knows where this will go tomorrow and the next month. And
yeah,
it will be wonderful to watch.
Yeah. For many months I was like, we're going to retire soon. We're going to retire soon. And now I'm just sort of like, we're just here responding to the present moment. So that means we close up tomorrow but I think it's a huge social support network for our aunties. And that's important to keep here for the moment.
Christina, this has been a wonderful and very meaningful conversation today, and I want to thank you for sharing your story with us.
Oh, I appreciate it, Meg. Thank you.
Yes, thank you for being on So-and-So, and we will be watching the Auntie Sewing Squad and you and your performances and your book that comes out in the fall of 2021.
yeah, looking forward to it. You're going to love it.
Well, there you have it. Another story about someone just like you, someone for whom sewing has been so much more than a hobby. It's a way of life and a connection to something bigger. If you know someone you think has an outstanding story, a story that should be shared on this podcast, please drop me a note to megoodman@theflintrock.com and put "You should hear their story" in the subject line. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite platform and visit our website, soandsopodcast.com, for more information about today's and all of our guests. That's SEWANDSO podcast.com. I also want to thank Bernina for making this program possible. I'm Meg Goodman, and I look forward to you joining us next time on So and So.